I said to the publishers, look, I want to do this book about Jessup, but we need to, the second half of the book is going to be about the guy who breaks the record, because there's going to be somebody breaking it any minute. That was my attitude. So it's going to be a book of two halves, but the second half never happened because the record hasn't fallen.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. How are sporting legends made? How do they endure? And what can they tell us about the time and place they came from, as well as our own? Chasing Jessup is the story of the fastest century ever scored in Test cricket by an England batsman. The one Gilbert Jessup crashed past Australia at the Oval to set up victory in the final test of the 1902 Ashes series. It's a record that since eluded everyone from Ian Botham, Andrew Flintoff and Kevin Peterson to Ben Stokes and the big-hitting Bazball generation. The book is the latest from Simon Wilde, who's been a cricket correspondent for the Sunday Times since the 1990s and has also released biographies of iconic players and even the England national team itself. And what starts as an exploration of that landmark innings becomes a rumination on the era it was played in, an investigation of record-keeping as a first draft of history, and a remarkable account of the relationship between sport, media and technology at a time of rapid change. Well, I spoke to Simon about what drew him back to this particular nugget of sporting history. We discussed Jessup's contemporary profile and latter-day equivalents, the place of international sport and athletes in Edwardian culture, some of the commercial peculiarities of the game at that moment, and the role of cricket in showcasing innovation in storytelling and distribution among the country's fast-expanding selection of newspapers. As you'll imagine, there are plenty of parallels with trends and debates in cricket and media today. Speaking of which, with Simon all but about to pack for England's tour of Australia at the time of recording, he also shared some brief thoughts about this year's Ashes contest and the state of Test cricket in 2025. That's to come. If you're enjoying the podcast, then I'd love it if you could help spread the word. Subscribe to the series, rate and review on your platform of choice. The social media details are in the show notes, so like, share and get in touch there. Keen to keep the audience growing and get more people in on conversations like this one, which is absorbing and surprising and quite a lot of fun. Here is Simon Wilde. So, I mean, I became aware of the book over the course of the summer. It was released in July, but I was reminded of it, of all the sources you could imagine. My father-in-law saw you at the Cheltenham Literature Festival. That's where he lives, and they went along, and he had a whale of a time and was sure to tell me about it. So I'm delighted you were able to join us on the podcast. You know, it's an interesting setting for Jessup's story in particular, because one of the things that emerges from this era is just how localized kind of interest in cricket and cricketers still was at this point. You're about 20 years into Test cricket being a kind of official activity. There's still only 2.5 kind of countries playing it, and the counties and the players they produce are still, you know, powerful in the popular imagination, as well as, you know, in political terms, should we say, in terms of how teams are picked and stuff. And Jessup is a very Cheltenham figure, and he's a very Gloucestershire figure.
Yes, as it happens, that's the place where he was born and grew up, so it was a nice place to go and talk about him. It seemed very appropriate, and when I was there, I went to his birthplace. The house still exists, and in fact there's a plaque outside about him, and in fact it's called Jessup House.
Right.
So yes, I mean, in those days, still cricketers were, probably sportsmen in general, they weren't really international cricketers as a thing. It was they were county cricketers or club cricketers, whatever it was. You played for your club and your county, etc., whether it's football, rugby, cricket, whatever, and occasionally you played for your country. So Jessup was first and foremost a Gloucestershire cricketer. In fact, the plaque on the house says Gilbert Jessup, Gloucestershire cricketer. It doesn't mention England. So he was a Gloucestershire cricketer, and obviously in an era where there was no television or whatever, if people wanted to go and see these superstars, if you like, they had to go and see them in the flesh. So England only played a few test matches each summer. There was no other, you know, there wasn't one day cricket or anything. So your best chance to see him was in a county match,
yeah,
or a festival match, you know. So yeah, of course, he was a local hero, really, as much as he was a national hero.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the idea of national team sport was, I think there's a point in the book where someone makes a contemporary reference to England as a scratch team. And it's just the you know, because you'd have different collections of players. And it this is probably the start of the era where you are generally getting the 11 best players, not always home and away, but you're generally getting the best teams against the best teams. But it's still quite a novel concept at that point.
Yeah, and in fact, I think they said that the sort of chat was that a team that goes on tour gets a sort of builds up a cohesion and a sort of team spirit and the rest of it, which the home team doesn't get because they're playing their local matches and then they get together for the test match and then they go away again. But the touring team stay as a body, and their touring teams in those days were smaller than they would be now. It might be 15 people. They'd stick together for months on end, do the tour, and then go home. But so for the duration of the tour, the visiting team was actually more cohesive than the home team.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's lots of that kind of detail in it, and there's lots of parallels or echoes, or I don't know how you'd frame it. But what was it that attracted you to telling this particular story at this particular time?
Well, it was I wasn't looking to write a book. I wasn't really looking to do anything. I just got. I got curious about Jessop because of Basball, really, because this England team, as we all know, the last 3 years, they've been playing a very attacking brand of cricket, and particularly the batting is, you know, ultra attacking. And a number of the players in this team got close to the Gilbert Jessop record, which was this 1902 century against Australia at the Oval. And the accepted figure was that he got to his century in 76 balls. And Johnny Bairstow got one in 77 balls at Trent Bridge 3 years ago. You know, Ben Duckett, Harry Brook got close a couple of times. Zach Crawley, you know, pretty much the entire batting lineup at one time or another scored a very fast 100 that came close to Jessop. So the chat was, who's going to break this record? It's going to fall. It's going to fall any minute, really. It was just like, you know, we don't know when, but it's going to happen. And it just got me wanting to go back and look at this record again and just sort of like almost just check it out and check the circumstances. I suppose at the back of mind I knew that the sort of way that cricket was recorded in those days was much more rudimentary than it is now. Obviously everything's digitized and computerized, so we know pretty, you know, we get it right these days, but you know, how accurate was this record? So that was the starting point. And actually when I then started thinking about a book, I said to the publishers, look, I want to do this book about Jessop, but the second half of the book is going to be about the guy who breaks the record, because there's going to be somebody breaking it any minute. That was my attitude. So it was going to be a book of two halves, but the second half never happened because the record hasn't fallen. So, I mean, I can explain to you the sort of anxieties I went through thinking the record was going to be broken, you know, almost between finishing it and it being published. So yeah, that was the starting point. It was Basball, really.
Yeah, I mean, Harry Brook, I think you make the point towards the end of the book, but, you know, Harry Brook almost did it twice in the same game. You've had Jamie Smith almost doing it kind of in his first year as a test cricketer, et cetera, et cetera. Johnny Bairstow a couple of times. But for all that talk, and the name Gilbert Jessop is one of those that, you know, for me as a cricket fan of a certain age, I'll remember David Lloyd or somebody mentioning at some point after Kevin Peterson's hit a six, you know, into a pavilion somewhere. But how familiar a figure did you find, for all that there's been this interest in his records, how familiar a figure is he in cricketing circles today?
He's just a name, really. He's sort of shorthand for very attacking batting. He's almost like the, you know, if you're talking about captaincy, you'd say Brearley-esque captaincy, wouldn't you? If something's very clever, he's the sort of paragon, he's the sort of benchmark. And Bradman-esque would be, you know, very high scoring bats, prolific batsman. They're the benchmarks. Well, if you're talking about hitting the ball miles and just going generally berserk with the bat, you say Jessop was the measure. You know, he was the one. So I think that's how his name still circulates. But I don't think most people know that much about him. I mean, I knew a fair bit about him, but I found out a lot of stuff, obviously, when I researched the book that I didn't know. So, yeah, that's what I'd say. Like W.G. Grace, he's a name that people know of, but how much can they tell you? Not that much, probably.
Yeah, and I mean, W.G. Grace, people won't be able to see it because we're obviously on a podcast, but behind my head, there is an image of W.G. Grace that I found in a charity, while I was setting up this office, found in a charity shop for a fiver. I mean, that's how ubiquitous kind of that particular iconography is even now. And there are reasons for that. Like Grace had a career that was, 40, 50 years long or something ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Jessup is one of those characters who's extremely big in that era. And I was actually quite struck by how big and how much consternation there was about him coming in and out of the team. And there were, there were examples of in my own cricketing lifetime that I can think of who bear comparison to some of that chatter. But, you know, the record feels like it's brought him back into this place and time. And it's funny that, you know, Brendan McCullum is the current world record holder and he has supplanted Jessup's record by something like 20 deliveries and there are 15 odd people on the list. But in England, it's just stuck in this place that it's been for, 125 years almost. What were the challenges in telling this particular story? I mean, you've mentioned there the sort of murkiness around the record keeping. But what was the primary friction that you found in putting this together?
Well, first of all, there was the score books don't exist, for example. Normally every match has got two scorers. So in this case, there would have been one travelling with the Australian team throughout the tour. And then there was a local one who would have been, in this case, the Surrey scorer because the match was at the Oval. Each county would lend their scorer for the test match that England played on that ground. So there'd be two scores. Those books don't survive. So that's a problem for a start. We haven't got the original data. The way people scored in those days wasn't as the way we score now, where it's every ball is logged against every batsman. So it wouldn't necessarily tell you the answer, but it would have helped. And I think if I had the scorebooks now, I would be able to come up in this book. I bring it down to, I've revised the figure, but I brought it down, but I've given a range, if you like, because there's a couple of overs where I'm not sure. The scorebooks would clear that up. That's the main problem. But what I discovered was, and the sort of delight of doing the book was that once I got stuck into the British newspaper archive, which is a wonderful thing, you can, now that it's digital and now that it's searchable, I realized just how many people were reporting on that match. There must have been 30 odd people in the press box at least. And you can reconstruct what happened through their accounts. Obviously, there's no TVs, no radio, but there was a lot of reportage. Newspapers then were sort of like the primary means of communicating information, which now just seems, I mean, I work for a newspaper, that's very interesting to me, but, you know, I'm just one of millions of voices these days. But then the newspapers were the thing. And what I found was that I could reconstruct a lot of what happened simply through the almost over-by-over accounts that the newspaper reporters gave, because the newspapers produced very long reports of everything. You know, if it was a parliamentary speech by Gladstone, you know, there'd be, you know, 10,000 words in the paper about it. You know, it was a completely different way of looking at stuff. So the reports on this test match were very extensive, and I didn't know that when I started, but that was really the gold mine that I sort of unearthed and that I used.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that becomes really fascinating going through the story and the way you tell it, you know, that kind of forensic deconstruction of the record takes you into this place where you're looking at the function that newspapers serve in that era. Is it's a combination of what would be an evening news bulletin and up to the minute sort of rolling news that you get in these stop press boxes, and on top of all the other things that we now think of a newspaper is doing, a sort of more sober closed box analysis reportage of a news story, and then the analysis and commentary and everything else that comes with it.
Well, yeah. I mean, now, you know, when I go to test matches for the Times or the Sunday Times, somebody will write a match report and somebody will what I often do for the Times is I do a sort of sidebar, which is a comment piece. I'll take an aspect of play and you know, deep, look at that very closely. It might be, you know, Ben Duckett scoring a quick 85 or something, whatever it is. Somebody bowling, you know, Shoaib Bashir bowling very well. And I might just focus on that. There's very little run of play, really. Even Michael Atherton doing a match report. It's not really over by over stuff. It's broader brush than that. But because we know that people who are interested have already watched it on TV or listened to it on the radio or followed it on a, you know, the BBC over by over account or Guardian, whatever it is, people have already consumed the sort of crunch information. So we're giving them analysis. But the newspapers 120 years ago, they were describing the events for those people who weren't there, because that's the only means of them ever finding out what happened. Unless you were in the ground, the newspaper is the only thing that could tell you over by over what happened. So reporting was completely different then. You know, you would not dream of writing like that now, but back then it was essential that you did.
Yeah. So newspaper reporting, its effectiveness is all in the delivery in this era, because the news that gets to people fastest will have gone through, used all the available technology that exists at that time. Faster printing presses, faster telegraphs, access to telephones, that sort of stuff. And in the case of cricket reporting, it becomes a proxy for demonstrating how effective your newspaper is, because you're getting the most up to the minute result of something that's probably finishing around the kind of the time the sun goes down, or, you know, the light fades at the end of the working day. And that becomes a really big part of this story. So, I mean, it's probably worth us, you know, I've introduced it in the preamble that this is England's fastest test century, but the context is important here, I think, in terms of how those two worlds overlap, those worlds of kind of media and technology and Jessop's particular innings in this game.
What was crucial really was in terms of me finding out what happened was that Jessop started batting at 10 past one in the afternoon. This is the last day of the match. England have been up against it throughout this game. They're trying to claw their way back in. They end up having to chase 260 odd, which is a big score in those days. Batting conditions were harder than they are now. And they started batting that morning and they collapsed to 48 for five. Jessop comes in 20 minutes before lunch. And, you know, they've got almost no chance at this point. They've lost a lot of their prime batting. So he is almost that. He joins Stanley Jackson, last recognised top order batsman, and Jessop. If England are going to still win this game, these two are going to have to do it. Yeah. But they come together shortly before lunch and they bat through to Jessop gets out at 3:15. So he's batted. It's 40-minute lunch break, bats for an hour or so after lunch. That sort of period of the day is when the evening newspapers, which are a massive thing in early Edwardian Britain at that time, the evening newspapers were really the things that went into almost more detail than the dailies. And they would fill their match reports up in this case with the latest info. So they gave you snapshots of what was happening throughout the afternoon, and that was Jessop's unfolding innings and the run chase. So it was perfect, really, because I did look at other sporting events that happened at different times of the day, and they weren't described so thoroughly, partly because it was just the wrong time of day. And then if you look at the morning newspapers, like, say, the Times and the Telegraph, their match reports the next day are far more broad. They've gone more broad brush because the evening papers have already done the blow-by-blow, so they tend to stand back a little bit more and take more of an overview. So the evening newspapers were crucial for providing sort of snapshots of what exactly happened.
And the environment that you're in as well, more broadly, you're right at the very, very start of the Edwardian era, you know, obviously pre the great shock of World War One, but you've got, again, this period of innovation and opening up and all the rest of it that these newspapers are windows into.
Yeah, well, the big thing here at this point was that Alfred Harmsworth, who became Lord Northcliffe, he'd got into the newspaper market in the late 1890s. He bought up the London Evening News, and which he turned into the biggest evening paper in the country. And then he created the Daily Mail, 1896, I think. The Express came along in 1900. The Daily Mirror began in 1903, so the year after Jessop's match. These were all sort of human interest, popular papers. They wanted to tell stories about people rather than before that, you'd get sort of very formal local council meetings or, you know, parliamentary speeches or whatever it is. It was dull, really. You know, it was lots of fact, but actually, this is not how people live their lives. They wanted to hear about people, really, and drama, you know. So Harmsworth gave them that in spades, really, and the other papers like The Express also jumped onto that bandwagon. So there was a revolution going on, and it was fueled partly by newspaper men who understood what people wanted. But also the technology was there to mass produce newspapers and deliver them. So Harmsworth was also using motor-driven delivery vehicles. Most other newspapers were using horse-drawn vehicles. I mean, it's incredible to think what we're talking about here. But so he just completely changed everything. He built much bigger presses than everyone else had in Fleet Street. You know, there was a revolution going on, and it was just happening just before Jessop's match. And so that story was disseminated much faster and more comprehensively than it would have been had he played that innings 10 years earlier. So
yeah.
It sort of hit a sweet spot, really. And again, I didn't know anything really about this stuff, just how much of a cutting edge tipping point we were at. But it's clear from the way the papers operated that that was the case.
Yeah. And then alongside that, you have experiments with film. So there's the odd session fraction of a session that's filmed and then screened in theatres for people during the series. And you also have the illustrated title. So that might appear a week, 2 weeks afterwards, you might get a couple of photographs of a game or what have you. But again, this is a huge leap forward in terms of what people are seeing outside of a sports ground and the impression that they're getting of a game. I mean, in that environment, what significance did England cricketers have in the culture that you were able to? Because you know, sport in itself is a relatively new concept as an organised thing. Here, we're talking, you know, cricket's been around for a very long time as a game played in villages and between counties, but organised football is only 50 years old, and you know, the Olympics is 5 years old, 6 years old at this point. What space do England test players occupy in the culture at this point?
Well, they're becoming more, again, to sort of feed into the sort of how the human interest stories were becoming more popular. Sports magazines or sports weekly papers like the Athletic News, those sort of things, were starting to promote the big players as celebrities, really, and they would have photographs of them. Full page photographs in the weekly illustrated magazines and stuff. So they were starting to present them as big figures. So C.B. Fry, who reported on the Oval Test and had played earlier in the series, he was a very interesting character because he was an exceptional sportsman, played in FA Cup finals, played Test matches for England, was a very good athlete, long jumper, all this sort of stuff. He set up a magazine shortly after the Jessop match, I think in 1904-5, called C.B. Fry's Magazine. And in that, he very much put the big cricketers at the front of the magazine and presented them as stars and heroes almost. So that was also starting to happen as well. I think they were becoming, I think the portraiture, if you like, of print journalism of various sorts helped promote them. And then something like Vanity Fair magazine, they would have sort of cartoons or caricatures, I think they were, of big celebrities, and they were often either politicians or sportsmen. So sportsmen were starting to become nationally recognised figures. I suppose W.G. Grace would have started that initially, but there were other people. Jessop was often described as the second most popular cricketer after Grace. Once Grace sort of started to fade away, which was happening around this time, Jessop was the people's champion, really. He was the most popular figure because they knew if they went to see him, he would entertain them. You know, he would be hitting balls out of the ground. So, I mean, you needed to justify your celebrity. He wasn't just going to be you had to do something to merit the public interest, if you like.
Yeah,
and he did.
Yeah, I want to talk more about Jessop's sort of personal standing and his kind of his profile at the time. But C.B. Fry is a really interesting character because he's not unique in that he is reporting on games that he's playing in and things like that, almost kind of like an early, you know, social media creator would be the sort of parallel now, and all the chat about how much do we let players tell the stories, or athletes tell the stories of their own competitions. But that's a wrinkle in organized cricket at the time. I hesitate to say professional, because some of these guys are professionals. Some of them have amateur status, but are effectively being paid through their involvement in the game, either holding sort of titles at county clubs, or because someone is paying them while they go round to report back. Jessup does some of that himself. How big a part of the sport is that at this time? And how does that kind of speak to the relationship between the press corps and the players?
I mean, shamateurism, as it was known, was a big thing. It was a hot topic. And in the 1896 Oval Test, so 6 years before Jessup, some of the professionals went on strike before the game and said, we believe that some of the amateur members of the team are being paid more in expenses than we're receiving in match fees. And then if we don't get, they were being paid £10 a match. And they said, if we want £20 a match, or we're not playing. And some of them backed down, and some of them stood their ground and weren't selected. But very quickly, the authorities, which was effectively the MCC, the Marylebone Cricket Club, based at Lord's, they increased the match fees for the professionals, because I think they realised this was they'd highlighted a very delicate subject, which was that the amateurs were actually being paid quite generously through expenses rather than formally being paid. But yeah, so Gilbert Jessup was got paid from Gloucestershire, his county, through being the secretary of the club, which was deemed acceptable for an amateur. It was all about sort of social class, really, and what was acceptable for an amateur to be doing. He wasn't going to be sort of a bricklayer, but he could be a journalist, or he could be a secretary of the club, which was effectively sort of, you know, organising a bit of stuff. I mean, it was a nonsense, really. It makes no sense. They were being paid whatever the job was. And the Australians, who didn't have such a system, they were merciless in criticising the English system. They thought it was a whole load of bunkum, really, and, you know, it was hypocrisy. And they would often highlight it when England teams toured there. And they'd say, you know, the amateurs are demanding expenses that are, you know, eye-wateringly high and all this sort of stuff. And why should we pay them that? So the Aussies didn't hide behind it. But in England, everyone won, you know, the establishment would prefer it if everyone just never mentioned it, you know. I mean, increasingly, again, if you look at some of the papers, some of the more popular papers, maybe the more left-wing papers, they would talk about the nonsense of amateur cricketers being paid. But yeah, Jessup fell into that bracket. So yeah, he's not, he wasn't any different from some of the other big players. W.G. Grace was the best paid amateur cricketer. You know, he earned eye-watering amounts of money as a cricketer, but he was, he was the game, really, in the late 1800s.
Yeah, and sort of in his case, as we say, you know, the endorsements and the various other commercial activities, as well as the commercial activities that were sort of under the table. That's a point worth bringing up again, because it situates you in a place and time, which is football had just worked out that it probably needed to be professional in order to thrive in the way that it ended up doing. But you also had just had the creation of the Olympics, which was amateur. So you had these parallel tracks, and cricket eventually kind of gets off and becomes a fully professional sport not that long afterwards. But yeah, it's again, it feeds into the profile of these players. And what was Jessup's, we've hinted at it a couple of times, but, you know, hugely celebrated. Is it the fact that he is so aggressive with the bat that sets him apart? Is there some other quality? Are there other ways, you know, looking at the reportage of some of this stuff as you have, the public Gilbert Jessup emerges?
So with him, I think it was everything he did. By 1902, he'd sort of developed back problems, so he didn't bowl so much. But in his earlier days, he was a very fast bowler and very aggressive. He'd sort of bounce the batsman a lot. He'd bowl very short. And he'd charge in, and he was full of energy in everything he did. So he'd run in fast when he was bowling, bounce the batsman. In the field, he was the best fielder in the world. Everyone sort of agreed that there was no one like him. He threw himself around in the covers or mid-wicket, stopping. He was a stopper rather than a catcher. He'd stop the ball, run. He ran out, you know, numerous people, because they thought the ball was past him and he'd get it and spin around and a direct hit throw sort of thing. So everything he did was, yeah, you couldn't take your eyes off him really. So he was that sort of character. And obviously a lot of the other players would be quite staid, you know, a professional batsman who needs to score his 1,000 runs a season if he's going to get another contract, isn't going to take the sort of wild risks that Jessop did because he couldn't risk losing his job. So a lot of people played in a much more conventional way and frankly quite boring, but that wasn't how he played. So he was a breath of fresh air, really, you know. And there were a few other players like that. I mean, Ranjit Singh, the Indian cricketer, the first non-white player to play for England, he was around at that time. He was a very glamorous figure for obvious reasons. You know, there were great entertainers, but there were a lot of pretty conventional players as well. But yeah, Jessop stood out for just doing everything with so much dash and verve, really.
Yeah, I mean, I know he's not an all-rounder by the time he plays this innings. It actually, he fits a template, doesn't he, of a certain kind of England hero down the years. And as a bowling all-rounder who keeps getting injured and then eventually has to become a batsman sounds very familiar at this point in time. I mean, were there the same echoes then of he's this big popular figure, the kind of average fan loves a Gilbert Jessop, and the more studied or, you know, the self-styled aficionado likes the other, or kind of he has to prove himself maybe slightly differently to that cohort.
He's the sort of luxury player that, you know, we've seen in football, and you get the debate now with some of the England players, like Zach Crawley is a good example. You know, England keep picking him, but he averages sort of 30, which isn't very good, but the management say, well, he's going to win us a match. You know, every so often he will play a fantastic innings and he will justify his presence, and that's what we want him in the team for. And so there's a public debate about his value. Is he worth indulging or not? And Jessop was very much of that sort. And the England selectors changed more than they do now. The panel would change. And it depended who was on the panel as to whether Jessop got picked. He got left out quite a bit. Some people liked him, some people didn't. But the debate went on sort of throughout his career. He only played 18 test matches in about 10 years. He should have played twice that, really. I mean, they played less test cricket. He should have played many more, but he wasn't trusted, really. And they didn't quite know. Once he stopped bowling so much, they didn't know quite how to fit him in the team. So, yeah, there's parallels with players of today who, you know, the argument goes on about whether is it okay if they only come off every, you know, 6 matches or 12 matches or whatever it is. And that went on with him a lot.
Yeah. And then in terms of style, it's dangerous to compare players from different eras. I mean, the players in this era, you know, I don't want to impugn their standards of athleticism or anything like that, but they're playing a very different game. One of the things that comes up a lot in this particular series is that they play an uncovered wicket, so the elements come into it in a much more spectacular way than perhaps they have in subsequent eras. But how would you characterize his style, and how much does that become a part of his brand? Because he's kind of more sort of somewhere between AB de Villiers and Rishabh Pant seems to be his approach to things.
Yeah, good question.
I mean, it's hard with no video as well to kind of get too much of a sense.
Well, so
of
I mean, what I'd say about him, so it's clearly the standard of fitness and athleticism of that generation was nothing like it is today. But I'd say that Jessop was an exception. He was a very good athlete. He played other sports. He played football. He sprinted. So he was the sort of 100-yard dash. You know, they didn't run 100 meters; they ran 100 yards. That was a common race. He ran very fast times in those things. He wasn't that far outside the, you know, the world record was sort of around 10 seconds. He was around 11 seconds. He was quite good. He was stockily built. He was short. He was about 5'8", even maybe a bit less. Very powerful. So, I mean, his nickname as a cricketer was the Croucher. And the reason was because he crouched at the crease. And he said he learned to crouch at the crease because it was like when he was starting a sprint, he would set off, in a crouched position because it would give him better acceleration. And he crouched when he was batting because he was going to charge down the pitch and attack the bowling. So that's why he did it. So it was sort of like setting off on a race. He was about to charge down the pitch. So he was very athletic. And I think, you know, if we watched him today, we'd still think, crikey, this guy's, you know, he's going some. The batsman I've sort of compared him to in the book, I mean, are two left-handers, really. He was right-handed, but Ben Duckett, left-hander, small, hit the ball in unusual places, square of the wicket, both sides. Jessop swept a lot. He didn't reverse sweep, obviously. Reverse sweeps weren't sort of known then, but he swept a lot square. And in terms of how he crouched at the wicket, that was like Owen Morgan used to do when he played for England sort of 10 years ago or so. And the way he bobbed down was commented on a lot. Jessop did that as well. So he'd hit the ball all around the wicket, which again in those days was if you went to a Eton or Harrow as a young man and were coached by the master in charge of cricket, you'd have been told to hit the ball between mid on and mid off, and that it was very sort of like there was a way to do things. Jessop never went to one of the big public schools, private schools. He went to Cheltenham Grammar School. His father was a governor there. When his father died, Gilbert had to leave the school. He then became a sort of teacher's assistant at various schools around the country, played a lot of cricket, but never got properly coached. And he said that's the reason that he played the way he did, because nobody ever actually taught him how to play the game. He learnt it for himself. So he was not orthodox in any way, really. He was a one-off.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny that I've heard people talk about that feeding into what we think of as correctness and elegance and other things that get applied to batting techniques, is that the amateurs were taught to play a certain way and that it was the professionals who kind of would play through the leg side and all this stuff. And these are all ideas that we carry with us and probably had carried with us all the way into the kind of 2020 era. What does his public profile become after this game? Because like you say, he plays 18 test matches. He plays a handful after this series. He plays about 500 times a summer for Gloucestershire, as does everybody else, and playing touring sides and all the rest of it, the volume of cricket they're getting through over the kind of four or five months of English spring and summer is quite something. But what happens to him as a public figure after this?
Well, one small thing is that, as we mentioned, he played for Gloucestershire a lot. The night of the game, he and three of the Yorkshire players who are in the England team all travel down to Cheltenham by train because Gloucestershire are playing Yorkshire the next morning in a three-day county championship match, and he's going to captain Gloucestershire. And F.S. Jackson, the person he's had a big stand with in winning the game at the Oval, he's going to captain Yorkshire. And they play there. And then the next day, Jessop writes a letter to the Sportsman papers complaining, saying, I've been inundated with so many requests for autographs since my innings on Wednesday that I'm now going to tell people I'm going to charge them for signing an autograph, and you've got to donate the money to a charity. So he said, you know, I'll keep signing them, but people are going to have to donate some money because I'm getting basically he was getting so fed up of being asked for an autograph. Now that was from spending 2 days in Cheltenham where you'd have thought things would be fairly sort of genteel. So he became a celebrity, definitely. And in fact, so much of a celebrity that when England next played Australia in Australia in 1903-4, England sent a team to Australia under Pelham Warner as captain. Jessop was considering going, but Alfred Harmsworth, editor of the Daily Mail, said, I want Gilbert Jessop writing about this test series for me in my paper. He was a bit annoyed that C.B. Fry had been signed up by the Express, and Fry had written some really good stuff, and the Express stuck it all over the front page, and, you know, he hadn't got anyone like that in the mail. And he wanted someone. So he signed up Jessop to stay at home in England and write reports about the cricket from the cables that were sent back, and Jessop had been to Australia before, so he knew the ground, so he was able to sort of like provide some personal experiences of what it was like. But he was commenting simply on the basis of cables, which were, you know, they were fairly thin, really, in terms of detail. There wasn't that much to go on. So Jessop was paid by Northcliffe to write for the Daily Mail and didn't go. So one of the reasons he didn't always play for England was because the journalism got in the way, actually.
Yeah, the media career.
Exactly, he started a media career. But he did play the next series in England in 1905 when F.S. Jackson had become captain. Jackson didn't really approve of Jessop because of the things we were talking about with the technique and the style. Jackson did go to Harrow. He was classically educated in terms of batting technique, and he disapproved of the way Jessop went about it, like a madman, really. And so after Jessop was out for naught in the first tests, he was dropped for the rest of the series, and Jackson was one of the selectors and was the person who would have had most say, really.
Yeah.
So he was out then for that series. He did play other test matches, and he played a series against South Africa in 1907, the first series South Africa played in England. And in the Lord's Test, the first game, Jessop actually played an innings that rivaled the one at the Oval in 1902. He scored 93 off 64 balls, and had he stayed in for a few more balls, he'd have certainly got his 100 faster than he'd got his at the Oval. Mm-hmm. But he got out. So that was another sensational innings he played. But that was kind of it, really. He played again in 1909 against Australia, and in 1912 against South Africa. Didn't really do much. Got injured in 1909. He had a back injury. So his England career after that was hit and miss, but he continued doing amazing things for Gloucestershire. So by about the time of the First World War, when he finished playing, he held the record for the fastest century in Test cricket, the fastest century in all first-class cricket anywhere around the world, and the record for the fastest double century scored anywhere in the world as well. So he held all the sort of like all the major batting records in a way for speed by the time he stopped.
Mm. What happens then in the decades afterwards? Because, you know, Test cricket comes out of its sort of Wild West era. You get more teams playing, you get higher stakes, which can affect the levels of risk and reward that people are prepared to accept. It basically becomes the game from post First World War through to the 50s that it becomes the game that it develops the reputation for being, which is a little bit more staid, a little bit more defensive and strategic. And the game gets longer as well. Like what happens to the sort of the legend of Jessop in this period?
Well, yeah. So Test cricket, as you just sort of explained, Test cricket becomes a more serious business. More countries come on stream. So you get India coming in the late 1920s, even before they got into political independence. The West Indies come in, New Zealand join. We've got England, Australia, South Africa. So we're up to six countries. Then in post-Second World War, when India and Pakistan get political independence, then Pakistan join. So it's becoming the recognisable world game that we know. But teams, because Test cricket becomes a sort of expression of national pride and demonstration of prowess, if you like, they're all terrified of losing to each other. So, when India and Pakistan play each other particularly, they just battled out draws because nobody ever took any risks. And England and Australia in the 50s and 60s, the cricket became pretty tedious, really. Again, nobody wanted to lose. So it was attritional. The matches had been extended to 5 days because 3 days and 4 days had not been enough. So it becomes attritional. The idea of anyone playing like Gilbert Jessop's is unimaginable, really. There was nobody like that. You did have the occasional dashing player. I mean, Dennis Compton played for England in the late 30s, late 40s. He was a very cavalier character, but England didn't really trust him very much because he threw his wicket away. So he was frowned upon and sort of told to sort of toe the line more. So there was nobody like Jessop throughout this period, because the whole business of Test cricket has become so much more serious. And actually, of course, crowds diminish as well. People stop watching because it's not as interesting. And that's why we end up getting the introduction of one-day cricket in the 60s, because they're trying to get the crowds back. And fortunately, also, the West Indies come along in the 60s with a much more attacking brand. You get Gary Sobers and people like this playing who were great entertainers. So things sort of pick up in the 60s, but there's a half a century of a sort of bit of a wasteland, really, in terms of entertaining batting. It goes out of, I mean, this is a very broad brush summary I'm giving you, but it goes out of fashion, really. So Jessop's legend burns bright in the sense that people who can remember him say, well, why doesn't anyone play like Gilbert Jessop anymore?
Yeah. Then, as you say, you do have that emergence of more attacking styles through one-day cricket and subsequently T20, and you've now had that permeate into the test game. Again, coming back to the inspiration for the story, does that make Jessop more relevant again? Does that make this story more relevant again? And the things that it tells us about cricket and tastes and audiences and all the rest of it?
Well, yes, I mean, I think so. And I think to go back to where we started, really, the fact that this England team can pride themselves on playing so aggressively, and they say, you know, nobody, their sort of message is nobody's done this before. You know, we're sort of reinventing test cricket, reinventing the wheel almost, you know. In fact, it has been done before. People did play like this, but it was a long time ago. So I think it's a story that's sort of come full circle, really. And but they, as I say, they haven't even these guys with their big bats and their endless training can't beat a guy who did it 120 years ago. I mean, to just briefly talk about the bats, the bat that Jessop used still exists. It's in the possession of the MCC in their museum. I've handled it. I've picked it up. It's very thin. It's nothing like the size of modern bats. I mean, these days, guys can miss hit a six. You could never have miss hit a six in 1902 because the power is simply not in the bat. It's just not there. Jessop had his bat specially made. He had longer handles than a modern cricketer would do. So he could move his hands around more maneuverability.
I was going to say, this is a very niche point, but I was fed something on social media the other day just to kind of bring the idea of technology and media back up to present day. The mongoose bats from a few years ago that kind of fell out of fashion. I think it was Matthew Hayden was the big purveyor of them and a couple of others. Are we talking that kind of style of bat? It's a niche reference, but cricket fans might get it.
I mean, people have. Yeah, I mean, when I've spoken about this before, people said, "Well, is it like were his bats like mongoose bats?" Not quite, because I think the mongoose bat blade was smaller, wasn't it? In fact,
yeah,
the blade is the same size, but the handle's longer.
Right.
So it looks a bit like a mongoose, but it's not really because the blade is the same size. This is how nerdy I was about it. I actually measured a Harry Brook bat. And I've measured the Jessop bat, and the blades are the same size in terms of the front, if you like. The depth, Harry Brook's bat in depth is twice as big as Jessop, but the front's the same, but the Harry Brook handle is shorter than the Jessop handle.
Right.
So Jessop had them specially made so he could wield it like a magic wand or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. That the template for an English cricket icon. You know, we've hinted at it a couple of times with people like Botham and Flintoff and Stokes, who I think Jessop kind of bears some comparison to, even though he's primarily remembered for kind of his batting. How much is the sort of differentiation? It feels like there's two different kinds of English hero. I mean, there are various others. There's, you know, your oddballs and your characters and everything else who become cult heroes. But the person who's the figurehead seems to tend to either be the sort of prefect character who's the impeccable leader, and then the real kind of swashbuckling maverick. How much is that template set in this era?
That's a good question. I mean, look, I think we in England, we like our heroes to be, well, there's probably two types, but there is definitely the sort of backs to the wall hero who will save a situation that looks lost. Like, I mean, Michael Atherton at Johannesburg in 1995, he batted for 10 hours, saved a game that we thought was lost. To go back to the 50s, there was a famous partnership with Trevor Bailey and Willie Watson at Lords, where they batted all the final afternoon when England looked like they were going to lose. And they got a draw, and ultimately they won the series later. That sort of backs to the wall heroics is definitely a sort of, it's the Dunkirk type thing. You know, it looks hopeless, but they triumph. There's definitely that. But I think there is also the Jessop stroke, Ian Botham stroke, Ben Stokes type of character who wins a match from a hopeless situation. You know, Jessop in 02, Ian Botham in 1981 at Headingley. You know, England are following on. The game's lost and Botham scores 100 and go on to win. And then Stokes, obviously, at Headingley in 2019 when he has that amazing partnership with Jack Leach. Jack Leach scores one, but Stokes scores all the other runs, and England win a game that looks lost. So there's definitely that type of swashbuckling hero who just, again, it always has to be against the odds, I think, with English cricketing heroes, certainly. The situation's got to be dire, and then we somehow get away with it. I mean, the situation is often dire in English cricket anyway, and we usually lose, but occasionally we win, and that makes it all the sweeter. And I think there is definitely that strand of English hero, you know, standing on the burning deck, and you know, he comes up with something remarkable.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. Well, we are all waiting to see, and you're going to go off and pack your bags at the end of this conversation, because we're waiting to see if England can do something remarkable in Australia over the next couple of months and win an Ashes series there for the first time in where are we, 15 years. How central now is the Ashes again to kind of test cricket and its viability? I mean, or is that a very parochial way of framing it? Are we actually seeing it just become something different?
No, I think the Ashes is crucial. Any match, any series now between England, Australia or India, whichever sort of whoever's playing the other, those series are what underpins the finances of Test cricket and also the attraction. People will watch those series. We've just spent the summer watching England play India in 5 Test matches, a remarkable series.
Yeah.
Just if for nothing else, that it went to every match went for 5 days, and it was utterly exhausting to watch, let alone play. You know, and the players were absolutely, you know, cooked at the end of it. So that was a remarkable feat of endurance by both teams, really. And I think it had a lot of people gripped. So it doesn't have to be England, Australia. It can involve India, and I think India are pushing England and Australia on their own soil. In the past, India were very good at home, less good away, but now they are capable in any conditions, really. So that's good for the health of Test cricket. The great shame is that India can't play Pakistan, because that is another Ashes series, really. But for political reasons, it never happens. But if it did, that would give the format and a whole another dimension again, really.
Yeah.
I think they're the three teams. You occasionally get, you know, South Africa, to be fair, are the World Test champions at the minute. So it'd be great if another country like that could come back and compete with the others. It doesn't look like it's going to be West Indies at the moment, but maybe it can be South Africa.
How important to the Ashes? The Ashes is in a curious place, because since that tour in 2010 that I just referenced, we've had this real odd dynamic where the series in England have been competitive, sometimes extremely competitive, sometimes they've kind of seesawed a little bit. And Australia haven't won here for a very long time. But the series in Australia have been embarrassing. They've been so one-sided that you're now having people, you know, my background is in industry journalism, and you'll have people say, I don't know if, you know, the Australian media industry is going to be as interested in this as a marquee TV product if England just come here and get beaten by Christmas every single time they visit. How important is it that England can go to Australia and compete?
Well, it is important, and it's about time they did go there and put up a proper fight. You see with even with the test right, you know, the broadcast rights, Sky Sports no longer show much interest in the Ashes. They're not even really bidding properly, and we've got some other people covering it. So. TNT, you know, if you're in the UK, you're going to watch on TNT. It is in the dead of night. People aren't going to stay up unless England are competitive. That's a given. I've been to Australia 7 times, and I've only seen England win once, and none of the others have been close, even going back, you know, to 1998, 2002, etc. But I sort of feel the last couple of times, the last series in Australia was a nonsense, really. It was COVID. It was completely ruined by COVID. England had no chance in that series. I mean, Stuart Broad said he ruled it null and void, didn't he? And I sort of know what he means, because if anyone who was there knew that this was just not a normal tour in any shape or form, you know, there was no chance of England doing anything. They weren't a very good team, but they had no chance. 2017-18, the previous tour, England lost Ben Stokes, and with the Bristol incident, he dropped out. They needed him. again, they were short of being competitive there. And then 2013-14 was a team that had sort of been very good and suddenly gone over the hill altogether, and they'd run out of steam. They'd just won the Ashes at home. They'd got nothing left to give the second time. So I can sort of make excuses for the last three trips. So I'm sort of hope there are no excuses this time, I don't think. You know, they're pretty much, they seem to be all fit. So if they get badly duffed up this time, they've only got themselves to blame. And it would be a worry, really, because it would suggest that England just, you know, cannot, for whatever reason, cannot get it together for an Australia tour. This Australian team are quite old. They're very old, in fact. But have they got one last big performance in them?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have, you know. So it's an interesting moment, really, because it's a test for England's Bazball project. You know, if they lose badly, that's McCullum sort of, you know, I'm sorry, but for McCullum's finish, really, as an idea, if he loses this one badly. And if Australia lose, then their team will, some of it will, they'll break up, I think.
Because
they are, you know, there's some 38-year-olds in that team.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting moment, and I don't know which way it's going to go, but I wouldn't, I'd keep your money in your pocket if that was.
Gilbert Jessop infamously didn't have a great record in Australia either. How different is a series in Australia from one in England, both on and off the field?
Well, I mean, Australians, if they come here, will say that they, you know, it's not easy for them. They get a lot of abuse from the crowds these days and the rest of it. It's become a bit like the Ryder Cup. But an Australia tour is hard. It's a hard country. You know, it's often said, you know, it's a hard country, and it's tough. The people are tough. I think Ian Botham said the other day, when you go there, 24.5 million people are against you. You know, they give it everything. The whole, you know, we talk about media coverage. The newspapers are relentless in their contempt for English cricket, and it's you know, it's ridiculous. But they give it. The whole country gets on side with their team and the crowds. So the India tour last winter, they had huge crowds, much bigger than. So the England's last tour, COVID, the crowds were down because they were limited. This group of England players are going to go in those grounds. They're going to be full, and they're going to be full of Aussies who are hating them. So it's going to be quite hostile, and you've got to be ready for it, really. Mm. So that is why Australia's hard. It's they're pretty uncompromising, really.
Yeah.
So it's not for the faint-hearted.
Just one last thing to think about, and then we'll get on to the three questions that we asked to everybody. What are your thoughts? We talked a lot about cricket media and the roots of it and the relationship with technology and all the rest of it. What are your reflections on the landscape as it is today? And what do you think is the most important story in cricket right now?
Can I have a minute to think about that?
Sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of candidates. There's the role of money. There's, you know, there's the women's game. The fact that India have just won that tournament, I think, could be incredibly significant for the sport more generally. But you know, it feels like it's at a kind of pivot point in its history.
Yeah, no, the most important story in cricket at the minute, I think, looking at the sort of, you know, the broad geopolitics of it is the tussle between franchise cricket and international cricket. You know, is international cricket going to survive from the severe pressure it's coming up under from the franchise formats? The top players do want to play for their countries. They do want to play in things like the Ashes, Big Test. They know that, they all know that Test cricket is the hardest format to play. But if the money is ridiculously large, they're going to go to the other stuff. And that is a problem for the game. And it's going to take some imaginative leadership from the administrators to keep the international stuff going safely, really. And then their track record is not particularly good on this, but that is an element to the game that's worrying, because T20 cricket is great, but it's quite limited, really. Test cricket is a very broad canvas, you don't want to lose it because it is fantastic. Everyone who's watched a good Test match remembers it, and everyone's played in one knows it. So I'd say that is a challenge for everyone.
Yeah, there you go. We're coming full circle again. The balance between international teams and other identities for all these players. Okay, three questions that we ask everybody. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Yes. when I was, what got me into cricket, I suppose, was that when I was 12, this is how old I am, 1972, my father won a competition in the Radio Times to pick the best England post-war test team to play Australia in an imaginary test match. I've got the bat over in the corner of this room that he won, signed by the 11 players that were in the team that he had to pick.
Oh, wow.
And as a result of that, he went on to Test Match Special on Radio 4, on BBC Radio. And he also won, apart from the bat and appearing on Test Match Special to talk about this competition he'd won, we got two tickets to Lords, and he took me to Lords to watch a Test Match against Australia in 1972. And in fact, Bob Massey destroyed England, and it was a disastrous game for England. But it got me interested in cricket. I went along, and then when he went onto the radio, I went up into the commentary box, and I just thought, "This is what a great job this is, sitting here, you know, talking about cricket all day and watching it." So yeah. that got me into journalism and cricket, or both at the same time.
Fantastic. What's your favourite piece of sports storytelling?
Oh, can I give you? Two or three of my favourite sports books. Is that
absolutely?
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I love. Well, a colleague of mine on the Sunday Times, Simon Hughes's book called "A Lot of Hard Yakka," which is a diary of his career as a county cricketer. I loved that. It was. It felt like that's what life as a county cricketer was really like. I think there's been a tennis book recently by Conor Nyland, an Irishman, a similar thing of a journeyman pro.
Recent guest on the podcast, of course, for people who've not caught that one yet.
Okay, well there you are. I loved that book. Same thing. It's guys who've told what it's really like, I think. And sometimes the journeyman player, if I can call them that, has more insight into the can see the bigger picture than maybe the superstars can. But one superstar whose book I really enjoyed as well was Andre Agassi's, again, because that was brutally honest about his life. So I don't know. There's three books there that I loved. But yeah, I love the stories that get tell it as it is, if you like. So a bit of grit in the oyster.
Yeah. And finally, what's a sports story that you'd like to tell or see somebody else tell? Before I'll give you a bit of thinking time on that, because one that fascinated me coming off the back of this was some of the anonymous sports reporters from this kind of white heat era of English newspapers. I'm trying to think of the guy who he wrote for one of the papers under an alias that sounded vaguely astral. And he worked from kind of the late 1890s to the 1930s. You said you were still finding his
His alias. Well, yes. Yeah, well, he wrote his newspaper, I think if it's the person I'm thinking of, his paper produced the ball-by-ball list that I used in this book that sort of unlocked the mystery of the Jessop innings, really.
Yeah, I feel like there's a Netflix series in that following a character like that around.
Yeah. One story, yeah. I'd like someone to explain to me how, to talk about someone from the Gilbert Jessop era, how Bernard Bosanquet invented the googly, because the googly is a great delivery. It's an act of deceit, isn't it? It's the greatest trick in sport, really. And, you know, a lot of people, when Bosanquet invented it, said it's unfair because, you know, how can I possibly play my cover drive if I don't know if the ball's going to turn in or away? You know, and I just like the idea of this, the deceit, really. I mean, there will be other sports that have other tricks like that, but I think it's the greatest trick in cricket, really, being able to bowl a googly. So that's a story that's not been told, I feel.
Yeah, I think that's one to get your head around for sure. But
Simon,
thanks very much for your time. You've been very generous with it right on the end of your big trip. And very much enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you. We'll be right back.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.